Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining the last panel and hopefully the most exciting panel of the afternoon with crude tankers. I don't know that anyone on this platform needs introduction, but all of these companies are U.S. listed, focused on tankers, but with slightly different fleet strategies. So maybe before we get started with the panel, we'll just go down the line and each person can introduce themselves and talk, just introduce your fleet and your fleet strategy today.
You start with me.
I will start with you, Svein.
So Svein Moxnes Harfjeld, CEO with DHT Holdings. We have 24 VLCCs in the water, so a pure play company, and we have 4 new buildings on order.
Lars Barstad, CEO of Frontline. We have 41 VLCCs on the water. We have 25 Suezmaxes and 18 LR2/Afras. So we are kind of partaking in all the big ships in the different kind of products we carry.
Lois Zabrocki, CEO of International Seaways, and we have 77 vessels, including 4 new buildings on order on the LR1 space.
I'm Harris Kosmatos. I am not the CEO of Tsakos Energy Navigation. I'm the corporate development officer of the company. We have a pro forma fleet of 72 vessels, 8 new buildings, vessels of every single category, from the very large crude carriers down to the smaller product tankers and the side sectors of LNG and shuttle tankers.
Great. Thank you all. Maybe just to get started, all of your businesses have been making a lot of money for your shareholders over the last 12 months plus. But as you sit here today and look forward for the next 6 months, what are the top issues that you are focused on for your company and the sector? Svein, you want to start?
So it's continued to make a lot of money, for one. No, and you know, we want to continue also with the disciplined execution of our strategy, you know, focus on good operations, service our customers, and I think in general that tends to be quite rewarding for everyone. We have a well-defined capital allocation policy, meaning that 100% of net income will go to our shareholders, so it's quarterly cash dividends, and that will continue. And in what we expect to be an increasingly rewarding market, that means also more dividends coming to the way of investors.
Lars, would you like to comment?
What he said. No, but just to add to that, you know, we are in a world where kind of political polarization is kind of a new buzzword. You know, we've been thrown black swans, gray swans, you know, all sorts of swans in this market. So obviously that's you know, one of the things that we're concerned about for the next 6 months, how both the Red Sea situation is evolving, also on what's going on with the shadow fleet, you know, kind of how the trading patterns going forward are evolving. So these are kind of some of the best words concerning us.
Yeah, so, you know, safety first. You know, I think that's a focus that we, you know, is absolutely top of mind for the tanker market, especially when, you know, you're really trying to work the fleet hard and focus on a very strong execution in these really strong markets. And capital allocation is, of course, critical. These are excellent times for tanker owners, and I think that the runway looks quite strong for us.
And from our company, obviously maintain the operational standards that we have built over the years, and continue to be one of the carriers of choice, if you like, of the big oil majors. We are probably one of the few companies in our peer group that caters to the long-term needs of our clients, and this is something that we have built over the years and we would like to maintain going forward. In a way, trying to balance fleet growth with fleet divestments efficient, optimal fleet utilization. So on the one hand, we are growing the fleet by acquiring vessels, building vessels against long-term employment. But on the other hand, we're also looking at opportunistic, strategic vessel divestments that will maintain the fleet modernity without depleting the critical mass that we have built over the years.
Thank you. Next topic, for those who have spent time looking at the individual sectors of tankers, you will have seen that there has been an outperformance in the mid-sized tankers relative to the large tankers recently. And I'll open it up to anyone who wants to start on the panel, but could you comment a bit on the relationship between earnings that you're seeing from mid-sized versus the largest VLCCs in today's market?
If I start, you know, we've been through a world that that kind of changed a bit when Russia invaded Ukraine. That kind of started to change trading patterns quite a lot, just because of how ports in Russia work. It was kind of beneficial for certain asset classes rather than others. It pulled ships from the conventional kind of, you know, normal trading commercial market into a Russian trade, and the kind of lowered supply of say Suezmaxes and Aframaxes in the non-Russian trading market. So you create an imbalance and increase ton-miles for that in particular. This also affected clean, of course, and products. But this kind of has hurt the VLCC a bit on utilization. We've had an inverted kind of earnings relationship between the three asset classes. But I think it's still so that over time, the economies of scale of transporting in big bulks will prevail. But this is basically the reason why we've been through this more than 2 year period now.
I would just build on what Lars is touching on and say that, you know, we have 13 Vs, 13 Suez, and if you combine the Panamaxes and Afras, 13 of those. And you've really seen the Suez and the Afras and the Panamaxes be very, very strong. It happens that the Americas, you know, North and South America, has increased production while at the same time you had this increased call on non-Russian crude oil into the EU, and that is a market that is really more mid-size, and it just kind of capitalizes on top of, I think, the Aframaxes being maybe the ship of choice, you know, for those that are loading Russian barrels. So it just dovetailed quite nicely into the mid-size space, and I think, you know, there's a little bit of an anticipation as we go through 24 and look for potentially OPEC to bring back more production in the second half as there's more of a call for that oil. And we should see the V's, listen, they haven't been poor. They just haven't been as strong as the midsize. And we anticipate that they should pick up in accordance when you see OPEC starting to bring on more production.
And just to add up or to complement of what both Lars and Lois have mentioned, and perhaps it could be a sign for the things to come in the future, that we are seeing today more interest or an elevated interest from our clients to build the larger carriers rather than the mid-sized carriers for long-term employment for new buildings. So VL, Suezmaxes, and Aframaxes, well, that probably is probably more skewed towards the LR2s, but on the crude side, we are seeing a pickup in the interest of the majors to build against long-term employment on those two sectors, on the crude, VLs and Suezmaxes. So perhaps that tells you something about the future.
Great, thanks. Any comments or can I move on?
No, all the experts have spoken. So.
Excellent. So I guess Lars and Lois, you both touched on the impact of Russia-Ukraine trade flows as it impacts that market. None of us can have a crystal ball, but if you think about some of the challenges and the rerouting that has happened with respect to the tensions that are happening in the Middle East, the tensions that are happening in Russia-Ukraine, if there is a resolution in the next 6 months, what happens to oil trade and tanker rates?
Well, it's, you know, the two schools of thought. One is that sanctions are going to be rolled back really quickly because the political cost of keeping these sanctions in place is too high for kind of the G7 countries and EU and so forth. Whilst the other one is, you know, it's going to take time. I think kind of different from the dark fleet, which trade in sanctioned molecules. This fleet is actually, to a large extent, going to be returning to the conventional market. But obviously, you're going to reverse some of these patterns. But it's all kind of up to where politically you decide to go in respect of these sanctions.
Yeah. We obviously have multiple geopolitical problems going on, presently, right? So you have the Suez Canal affected, as well as all the barrels that are have to find a new home from Russia and, into the EU. So, just kind of building on that, it seems to me there would probably be a middle ground where some trade would return to the closest provider, where we to have peace in Russia, Ukraine, and a certain amount of lessons might be learned in regards to security of flow, where you want to have a diversified, different countries bringing in, you don't want to rely always on, the one provider that has proven to be highly disruptive in the world. So I'm thinking a middle ground would be a place there where things would settle. But we just seem very far away today from having really a peaceful situation, where you can't even have your vessels transit the Suez Canal today, right? So they're very, very dicey times, for seafarers, for vessels that are trying to bring, for us, trying to bring our oil to the customer.
Well, I think it all depends on how the war will end, and under whose presidency the war will end. I think that will have a big impact. In either case, if we take the scenario that the war ends, sanctions will not be lifted overnight. There is a process. There are the Europeans involved. The shadow fleet has exited our competitive environment. It's not coming back. They are older vessels. Even if we are all lovey-doveys with the Russians, they are not coming back to compete with us. And the new building order book is low. These are the vessels that will come in direct competition with all our fleets. And the yards are full at capacity. We're not expecting any major deliveries over the next 2 to 3 years. If you were to place an order today, you're looking at 26, perhaps 27 deliveries. So at least for the next 2 to 3 years, the market is here to stay at very solid, very healthy levels. So the war, irrespective, we believe that the market is on solid foundations, just because the departure of those older vessels into the other side of the fence, if you like, which has depleted supply in the backdrop of increase in global oil demand post-COVID.
Can I just add one thing? I think the feeling of this conflict between Russia and Ukraine is very different this side of the pond than to Europe, where it's happening in the backyard. Europe really got shafted on the gas supply for the whole continent. And the hatred that is sort of now stuck in Europe because of this conflict and all the consequences is very, very different dynamic than what happens here. And I think Europe will hold a very important card in, irrespective of how this conflict ends, in whether they will let this country in as a reliable partner in providing fossil fuels or supply and energy to the continent. I think that's actually far, far away for that to happen. This can easily be sort of a 10, 15-year picture, right, before this is fixed. It doesn't matter who's running the country. The next guy might be questionable also because it sticks so deep. So I think that's something just to keep in mind and consider. So this will continue to offer some sort of disruption, I think, to the market.
Thank you. So if we come back to today versus the future when the world is a peaceful place, we are at a spot where the order book is fairly low. All of you have been growing through expanding your fleet, but some of you have been through new builds recently, and some have been through secondhand acquisitions. Maybe each of you could comment on your decisions for investments, and specifically, fine for you with your new builds. Let's start with the two new builds, and then go on to secondhand.
Four, but
two companies with new builds. Sorry.
No, we are not focused only on one or the other. We have done some secondhands also. It's fair to say that we would like to do more secondhand. It so happened that now we did a fairly big splash on some new ships. The order book, of course, is very interesting. We can talk about details in that, and it's very easy to count ships. I think what makes us quite confident is that even if you look at sort of the more conservative peak demand scenarios for oil consumption, based on analysis on population growth, reasonable economic growth, etc., peak demand scenario does not involve oil consumption falling off a cliff. It very likely involves oil demand plateauing for a good 10, 15 years before you can have changes to demand. And what we think is interesting in this is that, we spent a great deal of time last year with two of the world's leading energy research firms in understanding where is the fastest depletion of oil production and where can we expect new production to come into the market. And today, roughly 40% of global oil is seaborne. And I think it's quite reasonable to expect that seaborne will actually grow even in a scenario where top demand will shrink. And this means there will be need for transportation. And we felt it was important to move quite quickly. We wanted early deliveries. We got four slots in 26 at the two of the top shipyards that can actually build these ships, the ships that we want, and the ships that some of our customers want. So it was important actually to take some quick action in doing that. But it doesn't mean that sort of it's a end of the game for us. You could easily see us also do secondhand if we find the right opportunities, but they are now maybe more expensive than new buildings, so become less likely. So,
yeah, we've done our fair share of growing. We like to first of all, it's kind of established that this is a kind of a supply-driven cycle that we think we're entering into. I totally agree with science comments on both oil demand. It looks robust. I think it's a realization we're starting to see here that decarbonization is progressing, but at the same time the pie is or the overall energy demand is growing in such a kind of speed that oil is growing too. We like to compare this to the situation we saw in 2003-2004, which gave us a five-year kind of very, although volatile, a very good kind of period in the tanker markets, but different from that period, which was demand-driven. This is then again more supply-driven. So basically, Frontline wanted to get back to the position we had at that time with the amount of earning days kind of in our company. And we decided to grow then by way of merger, but it ended up being by way of acquisition. We haven't tapped the new building market yet. It's interesting to see that people are going into that market. I don't think it necessarily is the worst decision. I think the more interesting part of that story is that 2026 looks very, very difficult to find a ship, and also 2027 for any magnitude of ships is looking kind of fairly limited. So I think this story is just going to continue to evolve, and particularly so for the big ships.
Can I just add one thing? Sorry. I mean, I have great respect for your biggest shareholder, and although not your company, but he has actually ordered quite a lot of big tankers on the private side. So I think he's a guy with sort of, he smells the business when it comes. So I think it's not an excuse to order, but it at least gave me a little bit of confidence that he also went out to order quite a few VLCCs and Suezmaxes on the private side.
We have this Chinese walls, yeah. So obviously cannot comment.
I think it just speaks volume of actually what's ahead of us, right? Mm. And how we're all planning for our businesses going forward. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So absolutely for international seaways. I mean, it's now going back, over 2 years, but, you find your opportunities where you can, and ideally and particularly, when markets are low with, for example, the Diamond S merger, and, as and when we can, we try to find second-hand opportunities that will be very accretive and additive to shareholders to international seaways. We're bringing in some secondhand MRs that will refresh our MR side of our ownership base. And then, where are we building? We're building for LR1s. Why, the age profile on that sector is 15 years old plus. And, we wanted the Panama Canal beam for our customer base. And you really can't find those very easily in the market. So I think, you've got to look for every opportunity you can to differentiate, to lower the risk, and to strengthen your position going forward.
We've been a little opportunistic and strategic in our approach when it comes to growth. On the one hand, on the new building front, we were a bit opportunistic in the sense that we contracted 4 vessels, a couple of Suezmaxes and 2 MRs, against our usual modus operandi in ordering them without employment, only because we could get them at what we felt to be a good price. And we kind of jumped the queue on the delivery, so we're getting them at an earlier date than what we would have gotten if we would have placed the order in a different or at a different yard at the time. So we felt that it made sense for us to jump at that, very opportunistic opportunity that came about. Obviously, our intention is to have those vessels employed by the time they are ready to hit the water, and we're working towards that end. But that attribute of the earlier delivery kind of pushed us into that route. On the other hand, our recent acquisition of the 5 Viking crewed vessels, it was very strategic in the sense that we felt we are acquiring 5 top-notch green vessels, 3 conventional vessels with scrubber-fitted ice-class vessels, and a couple of recently delivered dual-fuel LNG LR2s, all of them against a top-notch client, one of our clients, Total of France. And through that, we felt that on the one hand, we are growing the company, we are renewing the company, because in parallel, we're also looking to divest some of our first-generation vessels, some of our Aframaxes and a handful of Suezmaxes. So they are coming as a replacement to those vessels that over the next few months could be departing the fleet. So that was the strategic element in it. And obviously at a price that we felt merited the investment and the potential accretion to our investors by getting not only very good attractive charters, but also affording us the opportunity, being of a relatively kind of medium-term duration, to enable us later to fix either. Okay, we're talking about 2 to 3 years down the line, but at rates that could be reflective of the market then, hopefully still a very strong market.
So if we stick on the topic of new builds, but switch to the theme of new builds with alternative fuels, any of you who saw DHT's latest earnings presentations find you had an interesting slide which presented a consultant study. And the consultant study, if I could summarize, showed a hypothetical adoption rate of new builds fueled by ammonia and fueled by methanol by shipping sector. And it was based on work the consultant had done in terms of kind of a bottoms-up view of those fuel sources. And what those graphs shows was containers and ro-ro vessels, maybe half of the new builds in the next 5 years, might be ordered with flexibility to be fueled by those fuel types, ammonia and methanol. it showed the bulk sector as the third highest shipping sector in terms of adoption, and then it showed tankers as relatively flat in terms of new builds, hypothetically being fueled by these sources. I'll start with you since it's your slide. What are some of your key takeaways from that analysis?
Just a disclaimer, I'm allergic against two things. One is German white wine. Number two are consultants. So it's all about sort of what goes into these reports, right? So let's take a step back. So in March last year, or February, March last year, we engaged Energy Aspects, which is a UK-based energy research firm, highly regarded, and the Rystad Energy, a Norwegian energy firm. And they were given the same scope, but they did not know about each other, and they were delivering sort of these projects for us, 300-page studies, and it was presented to us in December. And interestingly, the alignment of the conclusions were very high without, you know, knowing of each other. And what we were keen to understand was that not whether we can consume one of these fuels on the ships, I think are the technical departments of these owning companies know how to do that. We wanted to know what are the planned production facilities and expected production facilities for green ammonia and biomethanol. And what are the expected costs of these plants and the output that they're going to provide? Where will they geographically be positioned? How do they plan to deliver these fuels to the market? And lastly, are there any other industries that have a, you know, better or different willingness to pay for these fuels than what the maritime space has got? So in all of this, it was sort of a bottom-up analysis on this. And I think for the first takeaway is that, you know, it's going to be very expensive. So the customers are nowhere near willingness, you know, to pay for these fuels. So it has to be subsidized for this to happen one way or another. So in a sense, the end users will have to pay for it through taxation or paying more for the product that they buy. But then, you know, it was important then to look at the different trading patterns of different sectors of shipping. Shipping today consumes about 3.5 million barrels a day of the total oil market. I think if shipping is able to decarbonize, say, one-third in the next 10, 15 years, shipping has done a massive job. It's been very successful in fixing sort of emissions. But what happens to the remaining two-thirds of the fleet if this is the outcome? And I think it's kind of easy to say that ships with very fixed trading patterns and schedules, such as ro-ro carriers, container carriers, is easier to plan for logistics, delivery of fuels, you're more often in port, et cetera, et cetera. It makes it much easier. Whereas sort of large tankers are way out on the other end of the spectrum. It's very big engines, it's tramping, unknown sailing schedules, cargo might change ownership on the way. It's very long voyages, so it's very hard to sort of make this work. And as an example, on a VLCC, so the energy content of ammonia compared to fuel oil is probably, say for a simple calculation, it's a quarter. So we have 6,000-ton bunker tanks on a VLCC. So that means you need to put maybe a small handy-sized tanker on deck, right, to be able to have ammonia fuel in that ship to transport cargo. You know, it's a big deal, right? So you can fix this by two ways. Either you can build bigger ships, which maybe cannot go into the current port structures, or you can, of course, transport less cargo, which makes the transportation more expensive, or you can fuel very often, or, you know, you can fuel maybe six times on a voyage from the U.S. Gulf to China. So it requires a lot for this to happen, and the cost related to this is enormous. So I think it's all logical that other sectors will pick up and develop transportation with these fuels way before we see large tankers doing any of this.
Thank you. I'd invite any of the other panelists, if you have a view or as you think about some of these future fuels, any other perspectives to add?
Well, you know, it's... referring to kind of a study done by DNV, it's also a question of, and Svein was maybe touching on it, but it's a question of competition for these fuels. Although shipping is big to us, You know, in the global scale of things, there is a lot of kind of energy intensive industries that would rather have this fuel first. The panel previously was talking about aviation for once. I think one point I'd like to make is, you know, we're a tanker panel, so tankers is behaving a little bit differently than containers, for instance, gas carriers, car carriers. You know, we're all kind of different segments and have different clients and different kind of incentives. You know, it makes perfectly sense, and it's actually viable to build a car carrier that runs on a clean fuel, because basically the car producer is willing to pay for it. But on and also, you know, similarly on containers, because there are actually end users that are willing to pay an extra cent for those sneakers that have been transported kind of carbon neutral. But in tankers, at least up till now, there's still very, very few charters, our clients, that are willing to pay anything at all for kind of lower emission vessels. So it means that basically our clients haven't told us to go out and do these investments yet. So, and it's doubtful kind of when that will happen as well.
There certainly aren't enough collaborations yet with customers, but there are some, right? You know, we have three dual fuel Vs on the water on charter to Shell, and they are running both LNG and conventional fuels on those vessels. And it is a step change of transition toward the future. Our new building LR1s that we are building, we're making sure that, you know, the deck's stronger and the engine room's larger and the generators can accommodate. Eventually transitioning to an alternate fuel. And when we ran the numbers on the project, we're like, okay, let's assume that either at the first or second special survey, you will need to have a conversion. For sure, the regulations will only continue to tighten. That doesn't take away from anything that the gentlemen have said, you know, in regards to there will be very, very tough competition for these fuels. They are going to be very expensive. It's a massive investment, you know. I mean, the idea of a vessel having to bunker multiple times and the infrastructure that's required, you know, that's another large investment that needs to be undertaken. So there's lots of moving pieces here, and hopefully in the midst of all of this, we'll find the opportunity.
No, I mean, it's interesting because on the one hand, we're getting asked today to make an investment decision on something that we don't know if it will be around in 10, 15, 20 years from now. And unless we make that decision today, we're not kind of green and we're not following the, you know, the trend. So obviously, it's we're in a transitory phase. We need to see how all these alternative fuels will develop. It's like Nick Chacko said a few months back, it's like the COVID, you know, vaccine. They kind of all seem to work, but we don't quite know, you know, what will be the dominant, you know, vaccine going forward. Similarly with alternative fuels, you know, are we talking about fuels? Are we talking about fuel? Because today we are more or less have one fuel with certain kind of sub variations, and now we're asked to start building vessels that could potentially use 5, 6, 7 different fuels that we don't know how that will impact the vessel's resale value. What if we're going to build, you know, ammonia carriers or methanol or hydrogen or nuclear or whatever, and then 5 years, 10 years down the line, 15 years down the line, how are you going to sell that vessel? What investment decision are you making today over a 10-year? What kind of projections are you going to make today by building a new building with carrying either as an alternative or the sole fuel being ammonia? What kind of benchmark are you going to use? So it's a very big question mark that we're asked to make without any safety net. Are the charterers there to charter the vessel for 20 years? I don't think they are. Are they there to charter the vessel for 10 years? Probably. But the 10-year life cycle, it's still small for us. I mean, when vessels are built to last for 25 years, still a 10-year contract is could be considered on the low side for such, you know, early-stage investment. So we are monitoring the situation. We are not a first mover into this kind of transitionary issues like the scrubbers. We kind of avoided in the beginning, and then we, as the whole kind of debate progressed, we adjusted our policy accordingly. So we will monitor the situation, as I mentioned, and depending on how the when the dust settles, then we will make a decision. But for the time being, it seems that LNG is the most commonly available alternative, if it can be considered an alternative fuel. We will go with that, at least for the short to medium term, and then we will adjust accordingly. But it's a very big debate, and I don't think it will end anytime soon. The more it goes, the more we dig deeper, the more complications arise. So we'll, it's easy being in a governmental position and making all this funny and, you know, policies. It's not like the double hull back in, you know, the Open 90, that you basically had to figure out how to build a ship within a ship. That was tangible. You could tell how it could work. You just put a hull around the vessel. Relatively easy. But how do you pick a fuel that will be the fuel of the future in 20 years and have the reception facilities and everything on the port as the vessel moves along? Because it's one thing having a container that goes from A to B, and another thing having a tanker that goes from A, B, C, D, and back.
But I think it's just important to reiterate here that had this been a car carrier panel or even a dry bulk panel, some of these kind of ideas would potentially been a bit different. But ship owners are very kind of normally very good at and very glad or happy for options. So this is why you will always, if you go out and order a ship, you'll keep your options open. Dual fuel LNG is an alternative that is tested, proven, and works. But you keep your options open. That's why at Frontline we have 13 ammonia ready ships, but they're not more ready than that they're designed in order to cater for ammonia propulsion if that becomes the solution.
It's a relatively small capex to do it. people think this
cheap
is some magic, right? But exactly, it's very cheap options. So that, I think our industry, we have done actually quite well in the last, 10, 20 years. 10 years ago, we had eco engines coming in. It was 30% fuel reduction, right, on the VLCC, almost 30%. And with that, of course, much less emissions. And if you look back, 20 years ago, we were probably hovering around at 15 knots delivering cargo to refiners. Today, we're hovering around at 13 knots. And with the way IMO is putting up sort of trajectory of what the industry has to achieve and also what sort of banks are pressing on about, our industry is going to reduce speed again, which, of course, is good for the industry. But that's the way to reduce the footprint, right, is for the assets to stay longer in the game because they're still competitive, but they will operate at slower speeds. So that's the way to fix it in the near term rather than paying 20, 35, whatever million dollars on top of a ship without having fixed employment for that incremental investment.
So we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to switch back to conclude on the topic of financial policy. And a couple of you touched on dividend policy at the beginning of this panel. And as you've been making money for your shareholders, paying back shareholders with dividends, also pretty much all tanker companies across the board have been managing to dramatically reduce leverage in this process. So as you think about your balance sheets and capital allocation, maybe just briefly, how low is too low for leverage? How are you thinking about that balance?
So we brought down our leverage below 20% quite some time ago, and part of the reason was to be able to invest freely without relying on issuing new capital. So for investments, of course, and to be immediately accretive to shareholders. In 2022, we upped the dividend policy as a sort of subsequent event to having brought the balance sheet that far down. So we used to have a policy of paying out 60% of ordinary net income is quarterly cash dividends. That was implemented in 2015. And then we upped that to 100% in 2022. And we will continue with that. And we can do that because there's a meaningful difference between the P&L break-even in the company and the cash break-even in the company. So it means that the company generates what I call discretionary cash flow after even paying out 100% of net income to owners. And that cash flow can be used for investing in ships, buying back stocks, or paying down debt. So we think we sort of struck a good balance in how this is going to work out, and it gives people clarity on what to invest in and where the profits are going.
I'm not going to, you know, do the quote of low leverage, lazy management, but we, no, Frontline, we're comfortable where we are as well. You know, kind of, we don't have an outspoken dividend policy. It's not 100%, it's not 50, it's what the board decides, but we've said that you should expect around 80%. Of adjusted net income to be returned to shareholders. You know, we when I say comfortable around leverage, you know, kind of on the return on equity and the cash flow we're able to do, kind of, you know, being set up that way, we believe is kind of one of the advantages Frontline has.
Yeah. So our break-evens are $14,500 per day, and that runs the gamut of the entire fleet from VLCCs down to MRs on a blended basis. And this was enabled by, we're now below 20% on a net leverage basis. And, you know, we're not building cash, so we focus on free cash flow. And in 2023, you know, we put all of our free cash flow to work. So, you know, we paid down debt. We returned 16% to shareholders. And as well, we invested in our fleet. So we've been functioning with all cylinders go at International Seaways, and we've, you know, we don't have a stated policy of a percentage. However, in 2023, we were just below 50% of net income on our dividend return. And Q4, that was 60%. And we just, you know, we'll pay at the end of March here 60% of our adjusted net income, which annualized is above 10%. And Q1 looks better than Q4. So, you know, I think we're in a very strong position, and we're very focused on maximizing that free cash flow and making sure that, you know, we're building shareholder value.
Similarly, we don't have a stated policy on optimal debt levels, but kind of the rule of thumb in our case is that the optimal levels should be serviced by the vessels on long-term contracts, on secure revenue contracts. So as long as that portion of the fleet generates enough revenue to cover for the entire fleet's kind of debt service, then that's the optimal level. And this policy seems to have to be working. I mean, we have never restructured any of our loans, irrespective of how deep the troughs were in the past. This is how we are going to, or we are moving, you know, forward. We don't want to put the company under any risk by taking excessive kind of debt levels, and you know, always cognizant of the fact of the balance between vessels on secure revenue contracts against spot-related vessels, which are the ones that generate the revenue for the added cash that we may be needing for, you know, growth projects, dividends, and returning value to shareholders.
So thank you to all of you. We covered a lot of topics. We kept a full room. I don't know, Nicholas, are there other comments to make before the conference concludes?
No, just to say thank you to everybody. I mean, it is an absolute pleasure to look at this full room. Of course, we have a great panel with a terrific moderator. So all I want to do is say thank you very much. Great panel, wonderful day, and I think we have all earned our drinks that follow now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.